dance company?
Yes.
And it was that you danced the moonwalk?
That's right.
Are you still able to moonwalk?
Inappropriate circumstances.
My wife says inappropriate circumstances.
I have never identified more strongly with a political wife than I do right now.
If there isn't a murder in Richmond tonight in the governor's mansion, I don't know what, you know, I don't know what's going to
happen. Found slide marks on the floor.
In case you are baffled by the weird audio there, that was a clip of Virginia Governor Ralph Northam on Saturday. Reluctantly, I think, heeding the advice of his wife to not demonstrate at a press conference that all cable networks were carrying live, that he can still moonwalk, which would bolster his story that he once wore shoe polish on his face to impersonate Michael Jackson at a talent show. This story was supposed to be somehow exculpatory evidence for how he was not either the guy wearing blackface or dressed as a Klansman in the photo on his own medical school yearbook page in 1984 when he was 24 years old, which he had initially apologized for being in that photo some 16 or so hours before, leading to calls by just about every living member of the Democratic Party for Northam to resign and give way to Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax. But he is refusing to do that. To this day, hello, everyone, and welcome to the, I think, single worst Elon Musk simulation since at least the last Roger Stone press conference. This is the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason podcast. I'm your bronchial host, Matt Welch, joined by my fellow Reason editors, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Please all cough in unison.
Hey, Matt.
You.
Happy Monday.
Yeah, it's going to be like that. I'm not going to talk for the next hour. Catherine, I'm going to start with you since you grew up there. What the hell is wrong with Virginia?
I don't know, man. I got to tell you, I grew up in Northern Virginia, which is to say a totally different state from the rest of Virginia, actually, and sometimes also just a part of Washington, D.C., which means I'm not qualified to talk about either life in D.C. or life in Virginia. I'm disqualified from both. But yeah, I don't know what's going on here. The detail that really strikes me in this whole controversy is if you look at the full spread of the yearbook where this controversial photo appeared, there's actually blackface on the facing page as well.
Oh boy.
Like this was not like some kind of weird outlier. This was on one side there was blackface and a Klan guy, and then on the other side there was blackface and drag. And I don't know what to make of this. I mean,
hell of a party, sounds like.
It sounds like it was a hell of a party. No, I mean, I guess my big takeaway is just it is a reminder that some of our more enlightened attitudes about this sort of thing, about race and representation, are very, very late breaking. At the same time, I think it's fair to say that this was the rest of the country had mostly stopped doing this. I mean, olds, you tell me.
Yeah, I I'll tell you, as the oldest person on it, Northam is like 60 years old. And as Matt was saying, he's like 24, 25 when this picture was taken and in medical school. But I can remember I went to college in New Jersey from 81 to 85. And in my freshman year, I saw a guy dressed for Halloween in blackface. And people were, ragging on him and ranking on him and whatnot. But there's, you know, I don't think it was considered a good thing, but it was still somewhere acceptable in some kind of weird, fucked up way. And I think, you know, it certainly didn't make it out of the 80s. I don't even think it made it into the late 80s. But there were also sitcoms that would do various things that would have, you know, some kind of blackface routine that it was always about, oh, it was wrong, but somehow it was still permissible in the way through the 80s. There were a lot of gay jokes that you just, you know, didn't make it into the 90s. But it's pretty amazing. And I just want to, for me, the thing that is stunning is that his excuse was, well, you know, after apologizing for it and then saying, no, I didn't do it, but I did dress in blackface and other things. It reminded me of when Robert, Matt, please help me with who was TV's Beretta? Robert Blake.
Yeah, yeah.
Robert Blake was charged with the murder of his wife, Bonnie Lee Bakley. And he said his excuse was who was found shot to death in his car outside of a restaurant where they'd just been eating dinner. And he said it couldn't have been me because, in fact, I had left my gun in the restaurant.
Yeah.
And I had gone back into the restaurant to get my gun. It was like that kind of defense, which is almost so idiotic that like you're like, okay, let's just never.
Or does it make you believe it? Are you like this is like
that's it?
Right? I actually think there's a possibility that isn't him in the photo just because it's the craziest possible thing you could say. The other thing though,
I don't think it's him in the pictures. I think
who knows? I mean, it doesn't really matter since he's already admitted to wearing blackface in other contexts. But it also made me think of the Kavanaugh hearings, right? I mean, this is. You know, there was this sort of weird pressure during the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings where he was supposed to both deny wrongdoing and apologize. And that was something that really showed up, I think, in a lot of the commentary was like he should be sorry and he needs to be sorry. And if he's sorry, then maybe people will forgive him. But also, obviously, no one's going to forgive him for doing something unforgivable like raping or drugging women. So there was this kind of strange two-track analysis of how one is supposed to behave when confronted with this type of a public controversy. And I think in a weird way, what Northam did was both. He was like, I didn't do it. Yeah. I kind of did it. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done it. Can I please still be governor?
Let's pause it. The moral quandary. And Peter, I'll let you address this. Let's assume that he's now telling the truth. Peter, that it wasn't him in the photo. He only wore blackface that one time for a dance contest. That's what we did in 1984. And he's since learned from his black friend that that was insensitive. And he's dedicated his public career and political career to the cause of anti-racism. It's not like this. It's not like he's governed like Governor Blackface. So if that is the case, if he's learned from this, if it doesn't inform who he is today, why should he resign?
Well, I guess I believe that all politicians should resign on principle this afternoon. And for that reason, and that reason alone, Ralph Northam should resign this afternoon, as should Donald Trump, Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, all of Congress and every elected official in the United States. To Catherine's point about not remembering, you know, what it was like in the 1980s, I guess I grew up I was in North Carolina at the time. And my parents told me about Klan cross burnings in our city. And my mother took me to what I believe was the first, it might have been the second, but an early Martin Luther King Day celebration at a largely black church where a bomb threat was called in, of course, because it was North Carolina in the middle of the 1980s. And a kind of overt racism that we see. I think we have seen less of, though, perhaps in the last year or two, also a resurgence of a kind of overt racism was just a part of the aura, the air there. It was built into the culture. And what that did was it made the joking racism of let's go in a funny Klan costume a little more acceptable to a lot of people. And so, I mean, CNN has a post basically saying that while they haven't quite confirmed some of the details of the images, if you go through the yearbook, there's a bunch of other racist images.
Yeah.
It's like I say, all over
the
yearbook.
Facing page. It's amazing.
It's not just that one image and on the facing page. It's just kind of throughout. And this was just a kind of this was a part of the upper white, middle class, educated. I mean, this is a medical school, right? This isn't like a bunch of hicks having a party out in the back of their Klan club in the woods. This is a medical school, and this is part of the upper middle class white milieu, sort of how they express themselves.
And you still, I mean, in much more attenuated form, but you still hear stories about that, about fraternities at colleges, you know, and elite schools and stuff like that having slave auctions or trading in this kind of stuff. But Matt, to your question, which I think is a good one, and that's, you know, if Northam had acted better. I it's interesting to see if he can actually ride this out. But if that at that press conference, which I watched most of, I mean, he was like a mental defective, because when the reporter said, like, hey, can you still moonwalk? You know, and he was about to do it until his wife was like, you know, don't fucking do that. I mean, it was it's pretty stunning. And like, I think if he had handled it a little bit differently, we would, you know, there would still be a lot of questions, but it would be in a different place than we are now. But I would tend to think yes. I mean, that if somebody had been a complete dipshit and had not actually committed, you know, violent, you know, kind of irredeemable acts in their youth, and then had, you know, had lived a life that was, you know, in the opposite direction, I think that you would give people a pass in the same way, you know, going in the other direction. There's a number of kind of, you know, politicians or elected officials who had violent pasts going back to the 60s, whether they were in something like the Black Panthers or the Weather Underground or things like that. At a certain point, there is a statute of limitations on that if people have, you know, kind of renounced, you know, violence as a means, or violence or racism or whatever as a means of, I think.
Before we leave the topic, there's the partisan response to this has been kind of interesting to note. So it'd be, I'd like to get your take on it, maybe starting with Catherine. On the right, you heard a lot of people saying, oh, okay, great, now we care about this, when last week he was governor infanticide. So that really speaks to a messed up value system.
Which is also why this picture came out, according to, you know, it showed up on Big League Politics, and the guys there say that it was sent to them by somebody pissed off about the late.
So what do you think about that kind of value system, competing value system argument? And I don't know if you followed the actual infanticide controversy closely, Catherine. I do, as I always do with abortion politics, ran into the other room screaming. So I didn't really pay attention to it. But if you could sort of assess what you can take away from that, at least by reading Stephanie Slate's tweet storm.
I was going to say, I followed it via sitting next to Reason's resident pro-lifer, Stephanie Slade, and hearing her responses to it. And I do actually think, I mean, this is, as with so many abortion debates, this is not an easy question. This is the type of thing that we're sort of trying to deal with on the level of dumb, you know, headline-based politics and poll-based politics, when in fact it is an extremely deep philosophical issue that can't be easily resolved. And so this question of, okay, where are we drawing the line about the legality and morality of abortion, and why is it that we have such a strong moral intuition about the line, about our sort of the requirements on people's decisions being different 2 days before birth and 2 days after birth. You know, this is something that philosophers have grappled with forever. And needless to say, Northam was not well equipped to grapple with it. He basically stumble-bummed his way through a very bad attempt at a parsing of this issue. Slade had a series of tweets that were very, very good, where she basically said, we probably shouldn't assume that the thing that this mainstream politician was staking out, the position he was staking out, was post-birth infanticide is A-OK, kiddos. And that instead he was speaking to a very, very, very narrow possible circumstance in which a baby was born that was not going to be viable without significant assistance outside of the womb. And on that very narrow point, there are reasonable disagreements. And I think, you know, in a way, it's a shame that we had to convert this to a big, dumb fight about blackface, because I the questions around abortion are difficult and we should be talking about them. And people really do disagree in good faith. But instead, we're all just going to shout at each other about who was or wasn't dressed like Michael Jackson when.
Peter, let's make sure we don't talk about that issue anymore, because, again, running into other rooms and screaming. But one reaction I see from the left in all of this is to find every photo of Mitch McConnell in front of a Confederate flag, or, you know, Ted Cruz being seen with Steve King, who I think was like the co-chair of his national campaign, or something like that. Is that a fair and kind of legit response to go into that kind of whataboutism? Are there some other no-fly zones that we should be applying to politicians retroactively?
What's fair in politics? I mean, the politics, the rules of the Senate, it's all Calvin Ball. And if you remember Calvin Ball from the great Bill Watterson comic strip, Calvin and Hobbes, the only rule is that there can't be any rules. And so the game is just to declare new rules all the time in order to beat your opponent and to try and confuse them. And that's, I think, basically how politics and kind of political messaging in these fights end up being played out, and trying to say, oh, there are rules that we have to stick to. I mean, you can get people to agree to rules for a period of time, but those rules end up being broken, whether it's sort of boring procedural stuff in the Senate, like when you can and can't use the filibuster or how often, or whether it's digging up racist or racially tinged photos, historical photos of leading politicians, and seeing who has the most effective ammunition there, and whether any of that's going to work. And so, I don't think that there's even any point in trying to adjudicate that it's just going to happen and it's going to play out however it plays out.
But the Republicans make a mistake if they go after this with a lot of gusto, because they have virtually no representation among blacks, and they don't really care about.
And yet they've gotten major Democratic 2020 contenders, as well as Planned Parenthood, to call for Northam's resignation. And so they may claim.
Well, it's also
scalp.
It's not a problem Northam to resign. It doesn't, for the Democrats, it's relative,
sure, but it embarrasses Democrats. And the thinking is, yep. I'm not sure this is correct, but the thinking would be that the embarrassment caused to Democrats in the Democratic Party in Virginia could then benefit Republicans in future elections.
And there is this, this is, again, to come back to the Kavanaugh parallel, this is the stupidest, shallowest, most partisan proxy fight, because nobody has any resources or skills to actually have the fight about abortion. I mean, again, like the reason that people went after Kavanaugh, I think, or at least one reason that the series of events that unfolded around Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings did the way they did was exactly the same here as with Northam, which is that people believed that he had the potential to take abortion law in this country to a bad place. And so it sort of justified pulling out whatever weapons were available. And that was explicitly the case with this Northam thing. I mean, the tipster with the yearbook photo said, I brought this photo out because the infanticide comments were so bad. It's a little bit blurrier with the Kavanaugh thing, but it certainly was a contributing factor to how quickly the cry was taken up around him. And I think it speaks to how, even though we don't actually fight about abortion all that much, there is not any active kind of pending change at the national level right now. Roe v. Wade and the way it was decided and how abruptly it was decided continues to really distort our national politics in ways that people don't always appreciate.
Speaking of our national politics, Tuesday is going to... Oh, that's a perfectly fine segue, Nick.
No, it's a great segue. I'm just saying our national politics is just like such a train wreck.
I've been watching you slowly just to slip into a fugue state on Twitter, Nick.
It's like at this point, it's just, it's funny, right? Because otherwise it's just sad.
It's a clown car running into a circus train. And then the clowns end up riding the giraffes out of the wreckage.
But all the clowns are in blackface?
Yeah.
I didn't go there.
Can we drop the mic?
At least one of them.
Possible here. Tuesday is going to be, unfortunately, another State of the Union address from Donald Trump. We didn't manage to cancel it during the government shutdown. The two big backdrops that I see, at least, are obviously the ongoing negotiations over whether there's going to be border wall funding and how much, and whether the president's going to declare a national emergency But the other story angle that maybe I want to start with is that the president is expected to talk about drawing down troops from both Syria and Afghanistan in this speech. And last week, the Senate, in a rare moment of passing A, an amendment, and B, an amendment that pokes the bear of Donald Trump, put a non-binding resolution into a bill that's supposed to pass this week, rebuking the president's desire to draw down the 2,000 troops from Syria and some other stuff besides. Nick, how pathetic is it that this is the only expression of the legislature over the president's foreign policy is to express displeasure over a modest troop withdrawal after 5,000 years of the U.S. being everywhere?
It is a very, very pathetic, Matt. Very, very. At least two pathetics on a three pathetic scale. It's kind of horrifying. And, you know, this is one of those places. And I guess, you know, Catherine, to kind of extend your metaphor of or the discussion of, like, there are certain topics where when they are raised, people just kind of go apeshit and there is no engagement with one another. There is just this kind of, you know, darkling armies clashing in the night, or ignorant armies of the night on the darkling plain crashing against each other. And with foreign policy, we saw that when Trump said he was going to take troops out of Syria, people lost their shit. And, you know, MSNBC currently now, it sounds like Fox News circa 2001. Like, everybody there is about how, you know, we got to keep those troops in Syria. We should be putting more troops there, and also Afghanistan and Iraq and blah, blah. I mean, it's like, it's unbelievable the way this has scrambled everybody's jets. And the worst part of it, too, is that, you know, Trump is still saying, well, he wants to keep troops now in Iraq, to, you know, he said that in an interview that went live yesterday. You know, because we got to keep an eye on Iran, and we also spent a lot of money. I mean, he actually openly invoked the, you know, sunk cost fallacy. We spent a lot of money on a big, beautiful base in Iraq. So we ought to stick around and use it a little bit more. So, you know, he's not even consistent on these things, but hopefully the push will be there. I mean, it's good to see the Washington Post actually the editorialized in favor of getting out of Afghanistan, which is certainly long overdue.
Peter, there's been a lot of reporting that foreign policy, you know, lifers in Congress and in Washington are finding ways to kind of root around Trump's less interventionist instincts. So kind of gumming up the works on withdrawals far away and then closer by. You know, Marco is in Trump's ear saying, "Hey, let's go and intervene in Venezuela and maybe Cuba and elsewhere." Are we kind of in the worst of both worlds situation here? Like, we can't even get the anti-interventionist Trump in the Middle East, and meanwhile, he's going to be all Monroe doctrining at home.
I think if your question is this the worst of all worlds, and then you like name a topic, or at least one that's related to American politics, the answer is going to be yes. And I don't really.
So to review so far, Peter's positions on this podcast are fire all politicians. This is the worst of both worlds.
Also, blackface.
Clown car blackface. Yeah.
And also, it's never appropriate to do the moonwalk.
Yeah.
Is another.
I mean, to be honest, that's a life philosophy we just stitched together right there.
Never appropriate to do the moonwalk.
Okay.
I don't know about that. Corey Feldman used to, in the 80s, would bust a move. Yes, he did. And he would dress up like Michael Jackson.
You're not denying that it occurred. You're denying that it was appropriate. Yeah.
It is not. It is not appropriate.
Seriously, though, worst of all.
I mean, I will simply make the point that I've made quite a few times on this podcast, which is that there the Beltway foreign policy establishment has a whole bunch of different wars they would like to wage, but there is no legitimate sort of deeply a deep foundation. There's no policy apparatus for anti-interventionism in Washington, and as a result, a president who is, let's just say, not super well-versed in policy detail and in the operations of government who has some anti-interventionist instincts has a very difficult time, despite the president basically having the most authority over our foreign policy relative to, say, domestic policy. The area where he has the most authority is foreign policy. And yet, if he doesn't, he does not have people who can take that and put it into action and create policy around it. And President Obama, I was frustrated to some extent by this, too. And it's just very, very difficult for anti-war, anti-interventionist politicians to find capable people to implement their policies and make sure that they happen in a responsible way.
Catherine, you're an anarchist. What do you like best about the State of the Union address?
Oh, that question was a journey, I have to say. I like the thing that other people hate the most, which is the people in the audience that get called out for their inspiring stories, because it's, I feel like those things, those picks are always like intentionally slash unintentionally revealing about the real priorities of the administration. So I always look forward to the call outs.
So it's going to be a widow of someone who was killed by MS-13.
Exactly. There's going to be a blonde widow of somebody, probably actually a mother, because people seem to like it better when it's a young girl who's killed. So so that's, sorry for that out of context quote. But yeah, I think it's going to be the mother or widow of someone killed by MS-13. And it's going to be absurd.
I always like the profile of like the 43rd in line to the presidency person who gets picked. It's like the deputy undersecretary of the FDA whose job is normally like to make sure that like drugs have actually gone through 6 years of unnecessary testing or something before.
President.
And it's like maybe that person will be president tomorrow morning.
Based about that.
It was not a sitcom.
It was a drama.
Like, Kiefer Sutherland.
Oh, of course.
It's Kiefer Sutherland.
In my mind,
drama.
It was a sitcom, and frankly, the sitcom version is better.
Probably funny.
Designated.
There you go.
Designated
also,
survivor.
I'm looking forward to Ruth Bader Ginsburg Weekend at Bernie's Watch.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I want somebody to be dramatic and like bring in somebody in an iron lung, you know, like where they wheel them into.
But then it turns out it's Tony Stark, and the reveal is he's Iron Man.
Yeah. But you know, I just miss the showmanship. You know, we just go for
maybe Strom Thurmond is still alive, Nick, and we can.
I'm sure parts of him are still alive.
Sorry. Yeah. The backdrop, as I mentioned before, is also the negotiations.
This podcast just feels really inappropriate this morning. Very inappropriate in a way that
this feels
like,
totally appropriate to me.
I don't know what you're.
Like the moonwalk?
What is wrong with you,
like
Peter?
That kind of inappropriate?
It's a different kind of inappropriate, but maybe the moonwalk is coloring my perception here.
So, Betts, is he going to declare the national emergency here? And does anyone believe that there is going to be anything except the national emergency being the end game of the immigration and wall debate?
No, not at all. The New York Times ran a pretty smart report just a couple of days before the shutdown ended that had a quote from an advisor to the president from inside the White House that was basically like, this is a single issue presidency now. And the single issue is the wall. And so there's one way that Trump is going to get a wall, and that is to declare an emergency, because Democrats have made clear that they will give him a bunch of money, a bunch of other stuff for border security related theater, but they are not going to fund the $5.7 billion for 234 miles of steel slats that Trump has decided is the one and only issue that he cares about.
I do wonder if there will be. I hope that there will not actually be a declaration of national emergency during the State of the Union, I hope. But I do think there might be some kind of weird policy Hail Mary. Like, he's going to have come up with some kind of, like, partially thought through, harebrained, like, I can get the wall without congressional approval somehow. There'll be something where he can say, you know, and I am proud to announce that the wall will begin construction tomorrow. And everyone will go, yay. And then like whatever
well, like
it was, like whatever.
Right.
Well, not everyone. Yeah. Like whatever kind of weird like shell game thing it is that he comes up with during the State of the Union won't be viable. But it'll like it's possible that face saving on the wall could somehow occur during the State of the Union in a way that will defuse
this. But if there is a workaround that is available that isn't the emergency declaration and isn't basically Nancy Pelosi signing off on a wall that she has said that she simply will not, period, under any circumstances, sign off on.
Right.
I feel like we would have heard about it by now, which is why I think the most likely scenario is that not that he declares it tomorrow, but that he threatens it. And it might be us. Yeah. I mean,
well,
I think
definitely. I mean, every remark that he has, every public address that he has given since this began has been a threat to.
But probably, but quite possibly a more clear
Matt,
threat with like a timer on it. Like if I don't get this by the
I
end
think
of
he's
by,
gonna,
you know, the,
mm-hmm.
the
you think
three
it could
week
be the dead, like, the ultimatum deadline.
I'm going to do this.
Well, it's like, but I think he's going to declare it when the Patriots are visiting the White
That's
House. That's
To you know, as the Daily Beast exclusive reporting has alerted us, Patriots are the team of white supremacy. So that would surprise basically no one.
Gronk is nothing if not an alt-right, alt-white, you know, poster boy. Right.
Let's go to 2020 politics for 500, Alex. I guess, but it's only even numbers, isn't it, in Jeopardy?
Was the most Matt Welsh thing you could ever have said, by the way. Like you
really?
Let, well, you let, like mostly you pretend to be kind of like a normal cool guy when in fact you're like a big numbers nerd. And the fact that you would A, know the numerical increments of Jeopardy and B, let it slip because you're sick seems extremely Matt Welsh to me.
Thank you. Is that the right?
It was a compliment. Carry on.
Anywho. There are 20 people running for president, I think, on the Democratic side, or actually there's probably more like 11. Oh, no, I'm doing it. but there's a lot of people rumored. Last week we had...
Don't go towards the light, Matt.
I'm going to touch
stay
the silver
here,
cable.
Okay?
Cory Booker was the biggest new name to get semi-official last week. Catherine, why don't you talk about how Cory Booker made you sad?
Cory Booker, I actually thought it was possible that Cory Booker was not going to run for president and instead was having some kind of like a really serious midlife crisis because I follow him on Instagram and his Instagram had been converted almost entirely to like those inspirational quotes with a photo of the sunset in the background that
and
like
cat and
cutesy
hanging from a bridge.
Girls put. Yeah, no, it was fully hanging their cat like full time. And I started to get a little nervous that we were going to. I mean, it's not to say he couldn't be doing both. He could easily be doing both. He could be running for president and having a full fledged midlife crisis. But more substantively.
Isn't that what Beto's doing?
That's what Beto is doing for sure. More substantively, I am, you know, looking forward to / dreading his 180 degree pivot on school choice. So when he was the mayor of Newark, he was actually just a really incredible school choice advocate. This is, I don't know, 2006 to 2012-ish. I'm not sure when he was mayor, around then. Which I think was a moment when it looked like there could be a kind of bipartisan school choice agenda happening. Of course, he got the Zuckerberg money to put $100 million into New York schools that sort of included some reforms like merit pay for teachers. He just really seemed to be for Democrat in a city that's incredibly dominated by unions, willing to push the envelope on school choice and school reform in a way that was really encouraging. He worked with Betsy DeVos even in the past. And in 2017, he voted against DeVos's nomination. He is very clearly now running away from his record on school choice and on school reform, which puts us in this awkward position as voters and watchers of Cory Booker of having to decide whether we want to do a Straussian, like esoteric reading of his positions on school choice, right? Do we think once he has power, he will in fact be good on school choice? Because
no,
that is actually what his record is.
Of
and he
not
clearly believed it at the time. Now, sometimes those readings are accurate. See Barack Obama on LGBT rights. Mostly they're not, though. Mostly they're wishful thinking. I don't know. I would like
the oldie school choice
Cory Booker to be elected and surprise us.
So Obama shifted on, like, he got good on stuff when he needed to for electoral reasons. That's why he's flipped on LGBT.
But I, again, this depends on having stuff. The kind of the expert worker, you know, basically the worker base, right? To have somebody to install at the Department of Education, to install at in the administration, to run a kind of a school choice agenda, and the Democratic Party's education experts are not exactly
there's an alternate history where Trump is a huge issue that people yeah
just kind of forget about.
There's an alternate history where Trump didn't pick DeVos and President Booker did, and frankly that in that universe, like,
and
school choice is much better positioned.
The criminal justice reform aspect is hopefully going to be the best deployment of Booker in this campaign, just for him to be the person competing with Kamala Harris on this, because Booker has been way out front on criminal justice issues, on drug war issues. He's partnered up with Rand Paul a bunch of times. He's been pretty good on most of those issues, or at least pretty good for a politician. And so I hope that they vigorously compete and he beats her about the face and neck, but only rhetorically, Peter, inappropriate,
God,
et cetera.
This pod.
Listen, there's nothing we can do about it. Other 20 people out there, Peter, you wrote something about, speaking of Kamala Harris, about her Medicare Gandhi dancing. From last week. What the hell is she? What's her position now on Medicare for
All? I just want to. I don't
Gandhi
know
dancing?
What that means, and I don't want to speculate
or find
out.
I think it has something to do with Ralph Northam, though.
I just want to say that for whoever is spelunking through our archives 20 years from now, this is not me on this podcast.
Yeah.
And if it is, I apologize.
I'm going to explain.
Gandhi
dancer
is a slang term for workers who maintain railroads in North America. For each stroke, a worker would lift his Gandhi, a long-handled tool, and force it onto the ballast. Blah, blah, blah. This is extremely long. It seems just like it's
Urban
a little
Dictionary?
Bit racist.
It's not. It's from the classic Dr. Demento tune, Moose Turd Pie. And I heartily recommend everyone go to YouTube right now, pause what you're doing, pause this podcast, as good as it is and as inappropriate as it is, and listen to Moose Turd Pie, and you won't be sorry. Go ahead, Peter.
Most appropriate thing that's been said today. Kamala Harris, on Monday night, just after you listened to this podcast last week, was asked by Jake Tapper in a CNN town hall. Tapper said, well, you support the Bernie Sanders Medicare for All bill. And so Medicare for All has been deployed by Democratic politicians to mean a bunch of different things, but mostly it tends to mean this Bernie Sanders plan. And she was like, yep. And that plan, Jake Tapper was like, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but that plan calls for the elimination of all private health insurance. And she kind of nodded along, and Tapper was like, so what if you like your health insurance plan? Which, by the way, surveys show that a majority of people who get insurance from their employer like their plans. And she was like, well, look, private insurance is complicated. Nobody likes calling and, you know, scheduling appointments. So let's just do away with that. Let's eliminate it. Let's get beyond that. And basically, she said she agreed with the plan and supported it and wanted to eliminate all private health insurance, which, again, the Bernie Sanders plan would outlaw private health insurance as we know it in 4 years if it was passed. And that is kind of the essence of single payer. It has been for a long time. It's been one of the reasons why Democrats have been, even the ones who kind of, you know, they secretly like it, they've been kind of shy to say, yes, what we really want to do is kick 177 million Americans who have private health insurance off of their current plans. We want to disrupt coverage for that many people. And Kamala Harris did this in the first couple of weeks of running her presidential campaign. And the reaction actually was pretty interesting, even from Democrats. You had a bunch of prominent Democrats kind of try to distance themselves from this by saying, well, you know, I support a lot of other things that might be called Medicare for All. I want to allow people to have choice. We want to give them maybe a public option. You know, that's just a government-run plan that would be sold along private health insurance. And Harris, the next day, issued this non-backtracky backtrack statement that was like, well, I still support this Bernie Sanders plan. That's what I'm running on, but I also support all of these other options, and we could do, you know, whatever. We basically, let's call anything Medicare for All as long as it's an expansion of government health insurance. And so I think what it really kind of showed is why single payer in its strongest form, in the Bernie Sanders form, that which is built around the idea of disruption. That is kind of the fundamental idea of Medicare for All in its strong single-payer form, which is what Sanders is proposing. It's just not going to happen. There's just no political will to move 177 million people off of their current plans and onto a government plan. And so, you know, I really think it kind of reveals, like, we can talk about the cost issues. We can talk about, you know, all the government control issues, and all those are real problems that single payer supporters need to deal with and that critics should be bringing up. But the disruption is the kind of the core thing that they're not going to solve, and that Kamala Harris, even though she is going to say, well, I'm still running on this Bernie Sanders plan, she has not solved, has not figured out how to solve. And she ran into it pretty quickly in the course of her campaign.
You know, I'm not sure about the British National Health Service, but it's interesting that Canada, which, you know, has a true, you know, no one here gets out alive type of system where you can't go outside to a private market. I mean, there's some small parts of it now, but it was basically a 20-year process through from the early 60s to the early 80s over which they socialized their healthcare system. And I don't think anybody has factored that in the way you're talking about it, Peter, that this is like you got to eat the elephant a little bit at a time, because that disruption is probably going to be too much, and there's just
health
no
insurance
way
in the 1960s and 70s was very different than it is now. It wasn't comprehensive. It was often just sort of major medical or hospital insurance. It covered, you know, and so transitioning from a system in which a lot of people had that kind of insurance to a fully government-run system is just a very different sort of thing. You can look at the NHS, which was developed kind of as health insurance was becoming more common rather than after most people already had some form of health insurance. The other part of this, and this is, you know, sort of in some ways complicated for libertarians, is that Medicare for All under Bernie Sanders' plan would disrupt everyone who is currently on Medicare as we know it today, the Medicare for seniors. It would be a different plan. And now perhaps it would be a somewhat simpler transition for them. But this is one of the other things that we've found in a poll that was released this in January by the Kaiser Family Foundation, was that if you tell people that it will end their current Medicare, which would be true, it would replace it with a different government-run plan. But if you tell people that it would end their current Medicare, you get a huge drop in support for Medicare for All. And, you know, I think Democrats are just way out over their skis on this. They are not thinking about the path dependence that is caused by, that we have in the United States, where like the system we have is in some ways the system we have to work with. That is a problem in some ways for reformers on the right, or sort of market-based reformers who would like to significantly curtail or reform Medicare and Medicaid. But it's also a huge problem for folks on the left who really want to expand government health insurance and disrupt coverage arrangements that people like and have now.
Hopefully, though, one thing that will happen is, you know, most of the Democrats who have come out so far have embraced some form of Medicare for All, you know, whatever that means. And there's a push for that. there's also in Congress, in the House, Democrats are introducing a bill, and I guess they may be trying to do it in the Senate as well, but to lift the amount of, or to change the amount of income that is subject to Social Security taxes. And I think one of the arguments that we're going to be having, which is actually a good one to have, especially if we have it openly and honestly, which is a big caveat. But is, you know, Democrats, and this is certainly like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, I think Kamala Harris, you know, where the government should be supplying Medicare, you know, health care, a job guarantee, a guaranteed income, school, free college, et cetera, like all of these stuff right at the moment when all of these entitlements are kind of going tits up to begin with because of demographics and whatnot. And they're pushing that issue. And I think it'll be a good debate to have, because this is one of the things that's actually I found quite interesting about Howard Schultz. When he started talking, you know, the Starbucks billionaire who, you know, may or may not run for president, but he was just basically saying, like, you know, we've already got $21 trillion in debt, and that hamstrings us in doing whatever, you know, a lot of stuff, and it screws up the economy. But also, like, you can't expect the government to do everything for every person. And, you know, that's a debate that's long overdue, because people, you know, Republicans and Democrats both want the government to do a hell of a lot of shit that it really can't afford and hasn't been able to pay for in decades. And now, you know, let's join this battle and actually say, what, you know, given economic constraints, you know, we know that the government is not going to be able to raise much more than 18% of GDP in terms of revenue. It just it's been very hard to push past that for any length of time. You know, but we're spending 20-21% of GDP, and with these plans, we'd be spending much more than that.
One question will be, regardless of if he decides to run, will Howard Schultz be the only Democrat to raise these issues? Traditionally, in a Democratic primary,
well, that's why he's saying he would run as a centrist independent, and it's fascinating the level of you know, kind of umbrage that people in the media and on the left, because Schultz, you know, in Starbucks was like good on a bunch of social issues and they're good on immigration. They assumed, like, how dare Howard Schultz not run as a Democrat? Because if he runs as an independent, he might actually like draw protest votes, you know, away from the Democrat against Trump and let Trump win. And it's kind of like, fuck you. Like the guy, I mean, you know, he also is saying, like, you know, you shouldn't be taxing people at, you know, extortionary rates because they're successful. You shouldn't be so anti-capitalist. Like, he's not comfortable in the Democratic Party. And I think that that's something that Democrats haven't understood yet. They're still in the bubble where it's like all of the people they talk to are very much on the, you know, the progressive fringe, just in the same way that Republicans oftentimes get into their weird bubble where they're talking to people who just are not anywhere in the mainstream. And, you know, that mainstream is socially liberal and fiscally conservative in a lot of ways.
Speaking of which, Bill Weld, socially conservative. No, wait, the other way. Fiscally conservative, socially liberal.
Scratch that. Reverse it.
Is apparently contemplating a Republican run here. He's supposed to announce next week at a New Hampshire breakfast, one of those things. Yeah. One of those things that that's all presidential candidates have to do. This is only like, you know, a couple of weeks after saying at LibertyCon, talking a lot like someone who was going to be running for the Libertarian Party thing, a nomination, which he'd been preparing for the last 15 months or so. Catherine, are you happy to see him thinking about a Republican run? Is he even more delusional to think that there's room for Weldism left in the GOP?
I guess if there were going to be a debate stage, I would feel one way about it. That is, I would love to have Bill Weld as part of a crowded field of Republicans running. Since this is an incumbent situation, the payoff for Weld running as Republican seems less to me, but what do I know?
Yeah,
I don't vote.
The debate stage should be interesting. I think it's an undercover story, by which I mean I haven't written about it and I should, but it's remarkable the extent to which Trump has been and the Trump organization has been melding with the Republican National Committee as a way to head off any possible primary challenge. I mean, they're engaging in a level of kind of collusion with who is supposed to be kind of more of an independent arbiter that far exceeds what Hillary Clinton did in trying to rig her own pathway to the nomination of the Democratic Party in 2015 and 2016. So it might just be that that no one else would be willing to go through with this run, because we haven't seen, I mean, there's been the Larry Hogan trial balloon out there, and a lot of people are pretending to get excited about him. But John,
he's cuts a very exciting figure, Matt.
Look, you know, he's against gerrymandering. I'm happy for him for that. But there just doesn't seem to be a lot of candidates willing to take on Trump at a time when he's obviously weak and has a ceiling on his popularity, which is kind of interesting. One last candidate I wanted to get to before we bounce out of 2020 is Tulsi Gabbard, who is, as we've mentioned here before, an unusual special flower from the Aloha State. And she's what?
I don't know. There's somehow that seems patronizing.
It is.
I liked it. It was like
special
she
flower.
Was.
She's an island she flower, a, an exotic she's flower.
She's a human lay.
She's nope. an interesting.
Nope. God, yeah. Now you damn like it. Just abort. Like
also
early.
We can't
early,
walk your you know? Way away from that.
Abort yeah. 24 hours after the birth of that. Metaphor.
Nick, you mentioned
yeah, plan
you
B
mentioned
plan B.
That MSNBC is getting all hawkish. I noted that NBC News yeah. has a big piece saying that Tulsi Gabbard is the favorite of Russian bots.
She's a tool of the Kremlin, you know. And she's like, you know, the Satan kids playing Dungeons and Dragons in the 80s that Tipper Gore said were, you know, playing a game with Satan. They can't win. She's like that, but with the Soviets, you know. And it, let's stop pretending that the Soviet Union doesn't exist, because we all know it's really there. It's just behind Russia or something. But yeah, because Tulsi Gabbard, and she over the weekend, she put out a statement saying, like, I'm getting out of the new Cold War. I'm getting out of all of our wars, et cetera. And she speaks, you know, with the authenticity or with the legitimacy of an actual veteran. And she's like, no, we're getting out. She has, she said like oddly favorable things about people like, you know, the Syrian regime currently and things like that. But she has a very clear foreign policy vision, and it is the exact opposite of the establishment, the bipartisan establishment. And so you immediately see these stories. Well, then she's in cahoots with Russia. Because the only reason, you know, the only reason you would want to get out of Afghanistan is to what? Like turn it back over to the Russians because they had such a good experience there. But that's the way it plays out. And it's, you know, that NBC story, it's on NBC.com, is amazing because it doesn't actually have any good sources to say that somehow Tulsi Gabbard is, you know, is the favorite of Russians, is the favorite of this or that. It's just, it's really the worst kind of conjecture.
She's been on Sputnik a lot. Sputnik has covered her campaign a lot.
This is where we need to be, I think, forthright about stuff too, which is that, you know, like all of the analyses of, you know, Russian interference, et cetera, in the 2016 election, if you take them at their strongest form, they had no effect on, you know, the 2016 election. And yeah, we get it. You know, the Russians are really sophisticated, and they're going to come up with either even better Jesus memes for Facebook in 2020 and stuff like that. But it's like, you know, this attempt to link anybody who is against the status quo, where the U.S. has troops all over the world and we're actually engaged in the hot zones at any given moment or for 20 years at a time, is a tool of the Kremlin. You know, that's just, it really has to be engaged and rebutted with extreme prejudice, I think.
So before we get to our end of show, what are we consuming in the cultural realm segments, I am compelled to report that after last week's generational divide conversation about that, we indeed took an online poll. I put it on my Twitter account, which you can follow me, at Matt Welch, whether listeners preferred Team Mangu Suderman over the old Welch Gillespie, and Mangu Suderman
with
won.
Our old-fashioned things like books and records, you know, streaming and video series of sci-fi and games,
and the old millennials. You guys are old millennials, right? What are you people? You're Gen Z. What is your generation?
I'm a Zennial. I am a with an X.
Yeah, which is like, that's the most confusing cusper.
You're like coming up to 40, right? I mean, basically, that's like the
I reject the claim that I'm a millennial. Peter is a little more borderline as a person who's 1 year younger. The point is, we're younger than you.
The Youngs won And so as we start this one, I'm going to absolutely stay in character and say that the thing that I consumed that was of interest to me was a commercial at the Super Bowl last night. I recommend everyone watch it for hate watching purposes and nothing else. It's the Washington Post Tom Hanks narrated commercial that they spent $5.5 million just to buy the airtime. Lord knows the production values of showing, for example, you know, journalists were there and they show the picture of the moon, the flag on the moon. It's like, no, I don't think Walter Cronkite was in that ship, but you know, call me crazy.
Ship. You mean a movie set?
At any rate, it's amazing to me how much in this time of both sort of national disquiet and discussion over journalism and the president criticizing the media and the fake news and all this. It's amazing to me how much every time large journalism institutions and figures can't figure out how much they're damaging themselves by taking themselves so damn seriously. Like talking about like dedicating the Times Square ball drop to journalism this year. I think that happened. It's the amount of kind of self-regard and portentous Tom Hanks voice in the journalism industry is ridiculous and is damaging the very brands that they claim to protect. Catherine, what are you young people doing?
Before I give my personal recommendation, I do want to say, as a young, I didn't watch the Super Bowl, but I did get online and watch all the ads. So just so that we're all like super, super on brand here. And can I say the Google ad really kind of brought a tear to my eye? The Google ad that's about the Google Translate tool, where they show a bunch of people using it, and then they say, you know, sure, everybody disagrees and everything is awful and the world is full of strife, but the most commonly translated phrases are, how are you, thank you, and I love you. And I was like, that's so beautiful. Also, there were a lot of robots in those ads, and most of the robots were sort of like weirdly depressed, which I thought was interesting. There was a sad Alexa.
That's a sign of the times.
There was a sad Alexa who couldn't eat Pringles. There was a sad humanoid robot who couldn't drink beer. Like there was a lot of sad robots.
But then there was that weird one of Simply Safe, which is like a home security system that's kind of AI robot induced, which was really kind of creepy because it was like you could lock your doors, you know, et cetera. I mean, it was
or
like
your doors could lock
household.
You in. Yeah. No.
Exactly. Yeah. No.
My recommendation is that I realized I had not read the entirety of Terry Pratchett's oeuvre. And so I have gone back in reread sort of comedic fantasy fiction. The one that I read this weekend was called Mort. And it's about what happens if an anthropomorphic version of death gets an apprentice. It's delightful. I recommend Terry Pratchett to everyone. We wrote a quite nice obituary for him when he died a couple years back by Scott Shackford about how his sort of light and charming worldview nonetheless contained lots of great libertarian lessons about the ineptitude of the state and the joys of commerce. You should read Terry Pratchett. Love, Catherine.
Nick, what are you reading or doing?
Oh, well, you know, I watched the Super Bowl mostly for the ads and the halftime show, which, you know, I'm gonna just...
So again,
you know,
to be clear,
there, Maroon 5.
The young person version of this was better because I consumed exactly what you consumed, but it only took me 25 minutes.
Do you agree Nick, do you agree with Ben Sasse that the lead singer for Maroon 5 should have kept his shirt on?
No, I just wish he had better nipple piercings.
Do you agree with me that the lead singer for Maroon 5 probably shouldn't have been at the Super Bowl halftime show?
The Super Bowl halftime show should have ended after Prince's fantastic halftime show a few years ago, and which was like, I mean, nobody's going to top it. It's really beautiful and wonderful. It chokes me up just thinking about it. So given all of that, I actually kind of, I had such low expectations for Maroon 5. But, you know, the ads were, it was fascinating because between, you know, Andy Warhol, he had taped a commercial for Burger King years ago. There was an ad featuring Andy Warhol. There was one with Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind, when Anheuser-Busch was announcing that they were going to use wind power to make their shitty beer from now on, which was kind of amazing. And then the dude, you know, Jeff Bridges from The Big Lebowski showed up in an ad. It's a reminder that the baby boom generation is a fatberg that is clogging the sewers of Americans' cultural system. And I think we do.
I think of y'all more as a garbage island.
And I say this as a baby boomer.
But
this is clear. There's water backing up in the streets here that we got to get rid of. But having said this, and it might be partly because of the drubbing that we took, Matt, I actually, what I was reading while watching the Super Bowl, actually, for the most part, I was doing a bunch of things, but I read the 2013-2014 novel, The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P. by Adele Waldman, which was an extremely well-reviewed book about kind of millennial love set in New York and Brooklyn of 20-somethings of a literary set. So I'm trying to understand. I'm trying to, catch up, but always a couple years too late.
Peter, you obviously didn't watch any sports ball. What have you been consuming?
I'll just start by unreservedly recommending The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P. It's great. So I played a little bit of the Anthem demo. It's a big multiplayer kind of shooter that is rolling out sort of a limited preview. But what I really have been consuming is martinis and martini variants. And so I've been kind of interested in craft cocktails, classic cocktails for years, but I've never really felt like I grokked the martini. It just, I knew the recipes, I knew the formulas, I understood, some of the basic history, and as with a lot of gin drinks, it just sort of took me a while to warm up to it, to figure out exactly how to structure it, which gins and which vermouth to use, and so I've been making martinis in various formulas, in sort of various ratios of gin to vermouth, also with a little orange bitters. It's very important. I have also been making martini variants like the Martinez, which uses Old Tom gin, which is an older kind of gin that is a little bit sweeter, as well as sweet vermouth, and then maraschino liqueur. And then the Tuxedo Number 2, which is yet another martini variant that includes just a little bit of maraschino liqueur in what is basically a conventional martini structure. And so it's been really kind of fun to finally feel like I have these drinks figured out and I understand them and why they work and why good versions of them are good.
When was the martini invented? Is there
no one knows?
A clear,
it is a drink without a clear origin story.
Hmm.
That sounds like
you're anti vodka martini, or that's just not a martini as far as you're concerned.
So what I think is that you can make a vodka martini, you can probably make a good one, although it wouldn't necessarily be to my taste. I reject the idea that gin or vodka martinis are martinis unless they have some modifier beyond ice. If you're just getting stirred vodka stirred over ice or gin stirred over ice, that's fine. If you like that drink, great. But that's not a cocktail. It's not a martini. It's just gin stirred over ice or vodka stirred over ice. That's like saying that whiskey on the rocks is an old fashioned. It's not. It's whiskey on the rocks.
I am going to go get some Robitussin over ice here We'll call this.
You got to make some lean, Matt. Come on.
Gonna call this edition of the Editor's Roundtable podcast to a close. Thank you for listening, everybody, to this extremely inappropriate podcast that's going to ruin Peter Suderman's future political career. And stay tuned all week for other stuff.
It's this.
However, if elected, I will resign this afternoon.
Deal.
But just imagine, we have no idea. When you think of the last couple of weeks, by tomorrow, certainly by Tuesday, right? By Tuesday night, we'll be talking about something totally different and nobody will even fucking remember that Virginia is a state in the United States or something.
That's right, because it's a commonwealth. Goodbye, everyone.
Whoa.
Boo.